Blog Talk Radio.
Illegal
What's up? It is July 17, 2018, 8:05 on the East Coast. You're listening live to the Ant Canary Experience. I'm your host, Ant Canary. Welcome to the show. I got a couple of things. If you hear any noise in the background, we've got a thunderstorm that's just now might be rolling through, but we're going to do the show anyway. And also this morning at about 6 o'clock a.m., my grandson decided to show up 3 weeks early. He was allegedly due on the 6th of August. He decided he couldn't wait. He had to meet his pop, so he showed up today. And he's a healthy 5-pound, 15-ounce baby boy. As a matter of fact, I just ran in the door from the hospital seeing him. Matter of fact, I ran in, got set up, had a minute to come on. So that worked out pretty good. I just left the hospital seeing him. I've been putting pictures up on Facebook. He's perfectly fine. He was asleep. I tried to feed him. He opened up his eyes. He looked at me. He went back to sleep. So he's like his big sister. He will be getting spoiled. I pop, but it's all good. And you best believe when he and his sister get old enough to understand, I will be giving them the same information I am giving everybody else. So you best believe that. The call-in number, if you want to call in on this, 563-999-3682, 563-999-3682. And this week we're going to be talking about law enforcement. Usually I want to talk about this in tonight's topic. We're talking about Baltimore's corrupted police force. And the reason why I'm talking about this tonight is because a couple of Sundays ago, I don't know if some of you may know, some of you may not know, I drive for Uber part-time. And I was in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, driving around. And the radio stations weren't playing a whole lot of nothing. So I started listening to NPR, and they did a story on this. We're talking about that the Baltimore's police department was just jacking people up left and right. And I'm like, oh, crap, I got to talk about this. Because some of you may know, some of you may not know. I used to live in Baltimore. I've got relatives in Baltimore. I love Baltimore to death. I try to go at least once a year to visit relatives, get a bushel of crabs, and just have a good old time. And like I said, Baltimore to me, I don't care what nobody say. I don't live there full time like I used to, but I love Baltimore to death. And to hear about what these cops are doing, it's just jacked up. And every time I go, I don't have any issues with police, the police force there at all. You know, I do my thing. I visit, I leave. I don't give them any calls to mess with me. But this right here, this story tonight is just banged up. So I want to talk about this tonight, and also I'm probably going to be talking about, I'm going to probably talk about the NYPD, Chicago Police Force, and probably LA, because a lot of, unfortunately, they are, some of these police forces are just corrupt to no end, and it's pretty messed up that they are. It's pretty sad that, they're supposed to be serving and protecting us, and they're too busy shooting and killing us. So they're not doing a whole lot of protecting of anything. And I'm not saying that all cops are bad, because I know some cops. I used to work with cops. But they have got to get their act together. And if you've been keeping up with the news, you heard about what happened in Chicago. One day last week, someone was shot, and there's conflicting stories. And the thing is, I just love how some people, they will believe the cops no matter what. The cops can shoot 20 billion people, and these people will believe them anyway. I just love how they do that. Even though they don't live there, but they think that the cops are just, whatever. So before we begin, I've got a phone call, so let me hit the button and see. Okay, what's up? Hey, is this Brother Miko? What's up? Hey, what's going on? Can you hear me? Let me make sure everything's in right. All right. Hey, Brother Miko, what's up? Can you hear me? Thing going on. Okay, I'll just leave everything plugged up. Okay. I'll just leave the microphone on just in case. Okay, now here we go. Okay, might be a technical issue. Okay. But before we get into this, I just want to talk a little bit about the shenanigans that your president got into over the weekend. And I'm telling you, the stuff that this guy did, it brings up a whole lot of issues. One of the first issues it brings up is white privilege. And I bring that up for the simple fact that if anybody else had done or said the things that this clown said and did, they would have got lynched. If President Obama had done some of this stuff, they wouldn't even let him back on the plane coming back. They would have arrested him on the tarmac and probably put him on a private jet or a road coach and brought his ass back to the United States and impeached him with the quickness. That's not going to happen with this guy. He's a white guy, and ain't nothing going to happen to him. The Republicans don't care. They talk a good fight. They pretend that they're huffing and puffing like they're mad, and then they go back to doing the same bullshit they've been doing. So they're not going to say anything. It's going to be status quo because they don't give a damn. They're still getting paid, and they just don't care. This guy embarrassed this country in front of the whole world, and his fans are just going to sit there and say, well, Obama, well, Hillary, well, somebody else. They always want to blame everybody else, but they don't want to blame where all this crap is coming from. We tried to take back in 16, before he got elected, this guy was not, he did not have the wherewithal or the brain power to run his country. We tried to tell you. You wouldn't listen. And you get what you got. You get the government that you voted for. And now today, after what he said yesterday, which he was pretty much kissing Putin's ass, now today, Putin's not in the room with him, so now he wants to bring all that back. He wants to take it back. Well, it's too late for that. Cool invention called videotape. And everything you said and everything you did got recorded. So you can't take it back. You said what you meant. Oftentimes people tell you to think before you talk. Well, he did not think before he opened up his mouth. He threw this country up under the bus. He threw the FBI up under the bus. He threw the CIA up under the bus. He threw this country up under the bus. And the messed up thing about it is he was talking shit about the athletes taking a knee. And now you do this. And I've been getting arguments with clowns all day long that are his fans that want to sit up and blame everybody else for what he did. But, you know, this clown, I mean, I'm going to tell you something. This clown, he don't love America like y'all claim he does. Only thing this clown loves is money. The almighty dollar. And it is my hunch that he owes Putin plenty, billions of dollars. He's probably been laundering money for him for years. He owes them some money. He wanted to get elected. For the simple fact, he figured if he could get elected, he could lift the sanctions. He could start building hotels all over Russia and have a whole shitload of them in Moscow. So it's all about the dollar to him. He don't care about nobody in this country but himself. And he showed it this weekend. But his fans are going to blame everybody else. They're going to make excuses up for his sorry ass. You can't make up excuses for that. Everything he did and said is on video. And I hope that, I'm not a Democrat. I'm an independent. Only time I will vote for a Republican if they have issues on the table that will do something for me. If they don't have anything on the table to do anything for me, I'm not going to vote for them. I'm not going to waste my vote. Democrats make ad after ad and show and put this shit all over the place for people to see what he said and how he acted. And I'm not going to let you clowns sit up and try to convince me otherwise. Putin's got something on him. He don't want to get caught. And it's just crazy. You know, cognizant dissidents, and I did a show on this, where people, you know, you show them stuff, they have a thought in their head, and they believe what they believe, and you show them the opposite of what they believe, and they will sit up there, and they will take that shit to the grave. Now, what you saw this week was kind of like, well, it kind of gets into what we're talking about tonight, is where you have all these police shootings that are on tape. You see what you see, but you don't want to believe it anyway. So this clown said what he said, did what he did. It got all on videotape, and his fans are going to sit there and pretend that you didn't see it. Kind of like the Jedi mind.
My president, man.
Yes, I'm talking about your president. Hey, what's up?
You better leave my president alone, man.
Oh my goodness, man! You see the dumpster fire this guy caused this weekend. My God! Oh boy! I mean, where do I begin?
A white boy can make a million mistakes. He got the infrastructure to cover him.
That's right. You are exactly right.
A black man better not make one.
tell me about it. You know, I'm telling you, a black man should have had no. If a black man had been over there, he crossed his eyes a certain kind of way, boy. They'd have been all over his ass. But this guy over, I mean, this guy here, he goes over there. He talks shit about America, which I guess he claimed that he loved America so much. He talks about our enemies like they're friends. He talks about friends like they're enemies. He kisses up to Putin. He damn near fucks up the queen. She can't even. She walking behind him. This guy is a total fucker.
Well, you got to remember, man. The guy is not a politician, man. He's a businessman. He's an opportunist. He's not a politician.
Yeah.
The only politics that he understands is got to be in the context of business. It can't be in the context of social issues. Right. He don't got a clue.
Yeah, he don't. But
you know the thing about it, mm-hmm. America is really just a big business, though. So.
Oh yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Ultimately, that's what it is. Now we romanticize that it's something else and crying and shit over the flag and all that shit. But
mm-hmm.
ultimately, it's just a big business. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Sure is. I mean, you know, some of this stuff, we have to laugh at this shit to keep from crying, because this guy, it's like everywhere he went, people were protesting him. I mean, he won't even hear, and people were still protesting. He was over there, and they were protesting his ass like crazy, and then Sunday he goes golfing at his resort in Scotland. They protesting his ass. He don't seem to care. I think his mother's from Scotland or some shit. You would think, you know, oh, yeah, come on in. You know, you would think they would love him. They hate him over there. I mean, the guy is an embarrassment. But
well, he's really
they
not
voted
an embarrassment.
For him.
I mean, he's not an embarrassment. I mean, he represents what white folk are. So, I mean, who is he an embarrassment to? I mean, he's your typical white boy. So who is he an embarrassment? Think about it. What group of white folks would be an embarrassment to? Name them.
See, I ain't think about it like that. Yeah, yeah. He's not an embarrassment to them because he does the shit that they do. Yeah,
he is them. That's right.
Yeah. 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 See, I ain't think about it like that. So, yeah. He seems to be an embarrassment to us because he's not one of us. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Bingo.
Wow.
That's right. Now, he is an embarrassment. That's correct. For what we represent, he's an embarrassment. I'm talking about black folk. But to white folk, he's not an embarrassment. He's a typical white boy.
Man, I learn something from you every week. I didn't even think about it like that. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here bugging now. Yeah, you know what? You're exactly right. Yep.
Well, you look at
That's it like this.
Let's say that he was a Democrat. He still wouldn't be an embarrassment to white folk. You see?
Because he's still, so doesn't make he's still a white guy.
That's right. Bingo.
Yeah.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Ain't no charge.
Wow.
For that, I'm going to let you have that one for free.
There you go. I appreciate that.
I'm
going
to go with you, bro.
Okay. I appreciate it, but you're exactly right. See, I didn't think about it like that. Huh. He's an embarrassment to everybody else that don't look like him. But to everybody that looks like him, it's like, man, business as usual. Damn. That's right. Hmm. Wow. Oh, yeah, and I forgot to mention this, too. That's from right off the top. Today, 4 years ago, Eric Garner was killed in New York. He was choked. He was choked to death. Selling Lucy's on the corner. And you can put that on the list of things that black people cannot do. Black people in America can't do. They can't sell Lucy's on the corner. Can't sell water on the block. Can't barbecue in the park. Can't use a coupon at CVS. What else? Can't sell stuff on the street. Can't go swimming in your neighborhood pool. What else? I mean, the list goes on and on and on of things that black people cannot do in this in America. So 4 years ago today, he was killed, which is kind of bittersweet because, like I said earlier, you know, my grandson was born today. So, you know, unfortunately, his birthday will go down to something, you know, bad that happened. But, I mean, history is history. It is what it is. But, yeah, I had been posting things about that today on a Facebook page. You know, he was killed pretty much for no reason. And I'm probably, yeah, and more likely, I don't know what week yet, but I'm definitely going to talk about corruption in the NYPD, if not next week, maybe the week after. But the cop used an illegal chokehold, choked him and killed him. Even though, you know, when he did have him on the ground, what he should have done, as soon as he had him on the ground, he had everybody on his back. The cop should have just let up and let him, you know, get up off of him. They could have put the cuffs on him. They could have taken him to jail, charged him with that bogus crime of selling loose cigarettes, and he would still be alive today, I think. But, you know, used that legal chokehold, got off, you know the usual spiel, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, it's kind of bittersweet, but, you know, it is what it is. And I believe, and I think, last time I checked, I got to check on this again, but I think they're going to charge that officer. I have to double check that, but I think they're finally going to charge him for murder, I hope. So I'll check on that and I'll let you know how that goes. 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. But I will say this one last thing about your president. We tried to tell you, but you voted for him anyway, because a lot of people wanted a white man back in the White House to take it from that evil old black man that was in there for 8 years, and people still making excuses for him. But, you know, you get the government that you vote for, so hope you enjoy him. But, you know, he colluded with Russia. He knows he colluded with Russia. The Russians know he colluded with Russia. All about the almighty dollar. We know that, and they know that. So for anybody to say otherwise is blowing smoke up your ass. But Republicans are real good for what the old folks used to call back in the day, talking out of both sides of their necks. They got that shit down on lock. Because that's all they do, talk out of it. You know, they claim to love America, and this clown is trying to put it in his back pocket. You know, the same thing with these neo-Nazis and neo-Confederates. They claim they love America so much, it ain't about shit. So we got a thunderstorm going on, so hopefully it won't interfere with tonight's program. I hope it doesn't. Because if it does, I'll just come back. We'll just do it again next week. So I hope we're good. 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. And tonight's topic, hopefully it'll go tonight. without any interruptions. We're going to talk about Baltimore's corrupted police force. And what I may have to do is trying to speed this up because I hope the lights don't go out or anything. So what I may have to do is speed this up a little quicker. We may not go the whole 2 hours so I can get the show in, but we'll see how it plays. You know, hopefully it'll just rain and not have any thunder and the lightning, but I'll let you know. So it's currently raining right now. So, but I just want to read this article to give you some background on what we're talking about tonight. And I've got clips to play for you, and they will give you more more background on what's going on with these crooked cops. And I would love for a cop that's listening to call in to give their insight. And also have the chat room open too. So if you can't call in, you can get on the chat. You can get in the chat room and post your comments or questions or whatever. I keep checking it every now and again, see if there's anything in there. But you can do that also if you want. There's nothing in there yet. Okay, so you can do that if you want. Or call in 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. So I'm going to read this article. It was came out February 6, 2010. In the New York Times, and it's entitled, "In Baltimore, Brazen Officers Took Every Chance to Rob and Cheat." Stacks of bills, 100,000 in all, taken from a safe, garbage bags full of stolen prescription drugs dumped on the black market, a motorist robbery of $25,000. The crimes were not carried out by civilian criminals, but by Baltimore police officers. They are among the dozens of bombshells and one of the most startling police corruption scandals in a generation. In a trial in Baltimore federal court, witnesses and even the officers themselves have described an elite squad gone rogue, taking every opportunity to rob those they were supposed to be policing or protecting and barely bothering to cover up their deeds. The daily disclosures of dangerous, embarrassing, and shameless acts come at a particularly bad time for the Baltimore Police Department, which is battling a runaway crime problem in an environment already poisoned by deep mistrust of the police. The department was in fact under investigation by the federal government for systemic civil rights violations while the officers carried out many of their crimes, which included selling seized guns and drugs back into the streets, sending innocent people to jail, recruiting civilians to rob drug dealers, and using GPS devices to track and rob the innocent. Six officers have pleaded guilty. Four are testifying against the two who are now on trial. The case is a pattern of corruption scandals involving anti-crime units that rack up arrests and praise but do not have enough supervision, said Peter Moskos, a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, and a former Baltimore police officer who went to the police academy with one of the accused officers. "This one is far worse," he said. "It's shocking what they've done and how long they've been doing it." Case has raised questions about the beleaguered department's ability to reform itself or fight crime effectively. Baltimore juries, already famously skeptical of police, will now be that much less inclined to take officers at their word, and witnesses will now be even more reluctant to cooperate, an editorial in the Baltimore Sun said. The officers on trial, Detectives Marcus Taylor and Daniel Herschel, were members of the Gun Trace Task Force, a seven-member group of plainclothes detectives whose hard-charging tactics led to hundreds of arrests and the recovery of illegal guns. Last year, its members, including its current and former supervisors, were indicted on racketeering charges. Detectives Taylor and Herschel, Yeah, what's up? Okay. Detective Taylor and Herschel also face charges of extortion, using a firearm to commit a violent crime, and submitting phony overtime claims. They were, simply put, both cops and robbers, said Leo Wise, the lead federal prosecutor, in his opening argument. Let me see. In Baltimore, the members of the anti-crime unit were so reckless that they carried out elaborate criminal schemes, even as Justice Department investigators were scouring department records and interviewing the officers' colleagues as part of the civil rights investigation. The gun unit's criminal schemes appear to have started at least 5 years ago. But the officers believe that their victims would not speak up. More than likely, a drug dealer is not going to complain about their money being taken. His last name is Dondo. I can't say his first name. A former member of the gun unit who testified that week, Monday. He wore orange jail jumpsuit, having pleaded guilty to an array of crimes. Mr. Gondo estimated that he had stolen as much as $100,000 from people during his career and said he had once given a gun he took during a home invasion to a friend who was a drug dealer. The police accounts continue a drumbeat of negative news that has battered Baltimore's police, which was highlighted by Freddie Gray, who died in 2015 from injuries sustained while in police custody. His death was followed by days of rioting, unsuccessful attempts to prosecute the officers involved in his arrest. Last year, Baltimore had the highest per capita murder rate in its history. This month, this was written in February of this year. This month, an officer was indicted after a body camera video appeared to show him staging the discovery of a bag of illegal drugs near an arrest scene. In January, the mayor fired a police commissioner and appointed Daryl DeSouza, a department veteran, to be the city's third commissioner in 5 years. The fallout from the gun task force scandal has been substantial. Baltimore state attorney has dropped at least 125 criminal cases related to the task force and continues to investigate others. The public defender's office estimates that the number of tenant cases is likely to be close to 3,000. So I'm not going to read the whole thing, but let me just read you a few more things. One officer, for instance, testified that he was so worried about being caught that he scattered $20,000 cash from an on-duty robbery in the woods behind his house. The gun unit would sometimes try to deflect suspicion by lending technical gear, including bulletproof vests, to civilians so they could commit robberies. The officer served as lookouts. The detectives also kept BB guns in their police cars in case they needed to plant them on suspects and frequently placed tracking devices on the vehicles of civilians so they could rob their homes. Some of the civilians were suspected of dealing drugs, but at least one had no criminal record. The crew stole anything they could find of value: Rolex watches, dirt bikes, cologne, Air Jordan sneakers, a Chanel purse, heroin, cocaine, and prescription drugs. The unit, whose purpose was to get guns off the street, even stole and sold guns. One incident began with a traffic stop of Orris Stevenson, a 38-year-old with a long criminal history, in March 2016. After arresting Mr. Stevenson, the detective stole his house keys and read his driver's license to find where he lived. Four of the unit's officers entered his home and used tools to pry open his safe. They stole $100,000, which was half the money in the safe, along with 2 kilograms of cocaine, a $4,000 Breitling wristwatch, designer clothes, and other items, according to testimony. The gun unit supervisor, Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, then began to film on his mobile phone a video shown during the trial that purported to show the detectives opening the safe for the first time and discovering the remaining $100,000. Sergeant Jenkins then listened to Mr. Stevenson's phone calls from jail, he told prosecutors, and learned that Mr. Stevenson's girlfriend was seeking legal help to recover the stolen money. Sergeant Jenkins wrote a note that purported to be written by a woman who said Mr. Stevenson had gotten her pregnant. He placed the note on the girlfriend's doorstep, knocked, and ran off. So that's a little background on what these cops did. Like I said, we've got a thunderstorm going on, so I might have to accelerate the program to get it all in because I don't want to take the chance of the lights going out and all that good stuff. So I've got five clips to play. Two of them are long. The rest of them, well, one is almost 20 minutes. One is about 13 minutes. The other ones are short. But what they do is they give you a background of what these cops did while they were on the force, which is pretty banged up because, you know, you would think that these cops were out there serving and protecting, but what they were doing, they were serving themselves and they weren't protecting anybody. So you're going to hear these clips, and these clips are pretty, I mean, they're messed up. So I'm going to play these clips. I may just play them back to back to back so we can get the show in before it, you know, everything turns sideways. So we may not go up until 10 o'clock, but if we don't, hopefully you'll understand. And then next week, hopefully the weather won't be bad and I can do an entire 2 hours. But we've got here tonight, so we're going to do this. So this is the first clip. Play this clip, and then I shall return.
Baltimore is currently in the middle of one of the largest police scandals of recent memory, certainly of my memory. And as this case continues, some of the information coming out about what these cops were getting up to is pretty shocking. So there's this particular squad that had been like accosting drug dealers and stealing money. And then it goes even past that. It gets into extreme police brutality territory. So we want to give you those details. Prosecutors say that the squad, which was tasked with getting illegal guns off the streets, abused its power by robbing suspects and innocent people, raiding homes without warrants, and selling confiscated drugs, among other crimes. So conceivably, one part of the squad, I guess, could then bust the other part of the squad if they wanted to. Detective Maurice Ward, who's already pleaded guilty to corruption charges, testified that he and his partners were also told to carry gun replicas and BB guns, quote, in case we accidentally hit somebody or got into a shootout so we could plant them. The directive allegedly came from the team's sergeant, Wayne Jenkins, according to the Washington Post. And so we don't know for sure yet if anyone actually used that advice, although there is evidence that they did. Detective Marcus Taylor, another cop currently swept up in the scandal, was carrying a fake gun almost identical to his service weapon when he was arrested last year, according to The Sun. And so this sort of advice not only stops you from actually understanding why a shooting happened or why somebody was killed by the cops, but might make it more likely to happen in the future.
So this partly explains all the toy guns you always hear about when people are shot. Oh, somebody was shot, and oh, but you can understand it was an innocent misunderstanding because he was holding a toy gun. I'm like, there's that many toy guns in the world? And so some of them, I'm sure, were real toy guns, and some of them apparently were not, and this is too common.
Or were toy guns, but they weren't actually that person's toy guns, and it's sort of a get-out-of-justice-free card for the cops in that case. But then if we could just go back to the busting the drug dealers for a second, there's, I mean, the sums of money that are involved are pretty big. So at one point, this squad stopped a drug dealer during a traffic stop, took $6,500 from him, apparently found out where his home was, went there, busted in without a warrant, and took $100,000 out of a safe, which was just then theirs, I guess. I mean, he's a criminal, so who is he going to turn to? But that's not what the cops are supposed to be doing there. And apparently what they would do in some cases was they would stop a drug dealer and then ask them for insider information, saying things like, if you had a squad, where would you go to break in to try to get money or drugs or something like that? So they were sort of flipping the drug dealers, not to score arrests, but to score drugs and cash for their own gain.
So I want to talk about one other thing that is particularly terrible about this story. One of the reasons that they kept toy guns around was to plant it on kids they would shoot.
Yeah.
So they knew that they would sometimes get into what they called shootouts or just flat out shooting. One of the things that they would do, for example, to give you a sense of it, is they'd drive really fast into a crowd of people or kids that were standing around and stop suddenly. And then whoever ran, they would chase. Now, do they know who was in the crowd? No. Do they have any information on them? No. They did it just to harass these people, etc. And then, as you've seen in some cases, people would get shot, and then when they, and sometimes from the back. And so after they shoot them, if they're kids, What makes sense? Oh, they had a toy gun.
Mm-hmm.
So it is as bad as it gets. Now, look, 6 out of 8 have already pled guilty. So this is not conjecture. This is absolute reality. One of the terrible stories coming out of it is one of the cops was set to testify against the other cops.
Mm-hmm.
The night before the testimony, he wound up getting shot by his own gun. What a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so they haven't solved that one yet. My guess is it is related to the cops he was going to testify against.
Yeah.
You just watched a video by the Young Turks, home of the revolution. If you'd like to.
Baltimore
is currently in the middle of one.
Okay, sorry about that. So this is the second one. This is the longest clip I'm going to play. And then this one, they're talking about that pretty much the cops were cops and robbers at the same time.
Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to what's been described as one of the most startling police corruption scandals in a generation. In Baltimore, Maryland, closing arguments are scheduled to begin today for two Baltimore police officers who face racketeering, conspiracy, and robbery charges. The officers were part of an elite plainclothes unit called the Gun Trace Task Force. But according to prosecutors, the unit acted more like a criminal outfit. In his opening argument during the trial, the lead federal prosecutor, Leo Wise, said, quote, they were simply put both cops and robbers. According to prosecutors, the officers stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from city residents. They broke into houses. They stole drugs, then gave them to drug dealers. They carried BB guns that they could plant on people they shot. Six members of the task force have already pled guilty. Baltimore State's attorney has already dropped at least 125 criminal cases related to the task force, but many more convictions have been called into question. To talk more about this massive police scandal, we're joined by Sherilyn Ifill. She's president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Sherilyn. Explain what's going on in this Baltimore courtroom.
You know, Rachel, Amy, you explained so beautifully the scope of the case, but I think I want to zero in on some of the points that make this really unique. So first of all, remember, this case was brought by Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, to Mr. Sessions. Right before he left being the U.S. attorney in Baltimore, this is the case he brought. And he said the exact same line, Amy, that you just said, that this is about cops who were also robbers. He brought the indictments against the six officers in this elite gun task force unit. So that's important to remember, first of all, that this was the Republican U.S. attorney now working for Sessions who brought this case. And then all of the things that you described make this case really important. And it's important because we're right in the process of Baltimore launching this process, this consent decree process that comes as a result of the pattern and practice investigation from the Department of Justice 2 years ago. And as we launch this consent decree process, we are hearing the revelations of this gun task force unit. This is so important because what we're hearing from these officers who are testifying is precisely what we've been hearing from community residents about the reality of cops who are corrupt on the Baltimore police force. You described it, robbing residents, robbing drug dealers. We heard about kids being arrested on dirt bikes when they're 8 years old. It turns out these officers were selling dirt bikes. They were engaged with bail bondsmen in Baltimore County across the city limits to engage in this drug activity. And then even more startling, one officer who was scheduled to testify the next day in the trial involving this case was killed in a Baltimore alley. The first reports were that he was murdered. As you can imagine, this set the town on edge. Then it was unclear whether he was murdered. Then it's possible that it was a suicide. The Baltimore City Police Department asked the FBI to get involved. The FBI refused to get involved. This officer was killed the night before he was to testify in this trial, and we just learned this week one of the officers testified that he used to steal money with this officer who was killed. So we have an unsolved police killing. We don't know whether it was murder. We don't know whether it was suicide. We have all of these revelations, and we have this process, this moment in which Baltimore is supposed to be transforming its policing through this consent decree.
Talk about how long this went on for.
Years. Some say it may have been up to 10 years, but some say at least 5 years that this was going on. And that's why it's important, Amy, because this was not uncovered by the Baltimore State's attorney. This was not uncovered by City Hall. This was not uncovered by Internal Affairs. In fact, the police officers who testified this week said that Internal Affairs was just part of the culture. This was only uncovered by a federal investigation into the Baltimore City Police Department. So the questions on the table for us have to be, Amy, what are the structural changes that the city is prepared to put in place, not only because of the consent decree process, but because there seemed to be no way to find out that this kind of criminality was happening within the police department.
So you keep mentioning the consent decree.
Yes.
And consent decrees are under siege all over the country,
right,
during the Trump administration. Explain what it was, what this is.
So the consent decree came as a result of the federal investigation. This is under the Obama Justice Department of the Baltimore Police Department. They laid out a pattern and practice of unconstitutional policing in the city and then negotiated with the city, said, you know, we're suing you, and negotiated with the city an agreement, a consent decree, which is a federally supervised settlement. And that consent decree is supposed to do certain kinds of things that will transform policing in Baltimore. But in the meantime, we had a new election, and Mr. Trump came into office, and his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, doesn't believe in consent decrees. And in fact, right up at the moment that the consent decree was to be fully approved by the federal judge, Sessions tried to pull out of the consent decree process. In fact, we tried to intervene in the case to make sure that this process would go forward. The judge, to his credit, would not allow the Department of Justice out. They said, you negotiated the consent decree, you're staying in this. So we're very closely monitoring this process to make sure that the Department of Justice does its job, but also to make sure that the city and the Department of Justice are taking all of this into account in terms of thinking through what kind of transformation is needed in Baltimore.
So talk about the state's attorney now dropping 125 mm-hmm. cases and looking into many more.
Well, think about all of the people who were arrested as a result of the officers in this task force. All of those convictions, all of those pleas. I mean, even if you weren't convicted, you got an arrest record. All of that has to now come into question. And so the state's attorney has a big job in front of her to deal with that. We also have one other shoe that hasn't dropped in this case yet, Amy, which is quite shocking. The reports are that there was an assistant state's attorney that tipped off the officers that they were under investigation. We haven't heard the name of that assistant state's attorney yet, but that's yet another issue that has to be dealt
explain
with.
Explain that.
Well, how did the officers find out? At some point, the officers found out that the feds were looking into this, although I have to say the officers engaged in this conduct even during the federal pattern and practice investigation. That's how bold they were. But at some point, it's reported
that— And these, the officers on trial, are Detective Daniel Herschel and
right.
Detective Marcus Taylor.
That's right. They wouldn't accept the plea. And so the question is, who tipped them off? Who tipped off the group of officers that they were being investigated? And the rumor is that there was an assistant state's attorney that tipped them off. We haven't heard the name yet. We haven't had confirmation of that. But that would, once again, here's something that ostensibly doesn't even fall within the bounds of the consent decree, but that has to be taken up. So there are a lot of different proposals in Baltimore right now that Baltimore needs a police commission. That first of all, we need a full investigation and a scrubbing from top to bottom, a NAP commission for Baltimore. Many people are suggesting that we need an ongoing commission that oversees the Baltimore Police Department, that it can't just be the one police commissioner. But, you know, one of the things that's most important, Amy, here is people have to learn out of this case that you have to listen to the community. People in the community have been talking about the officers in this force, have been talking about the kinds of corruption that's now being confirmed, and they were disbelieved. And so when people looked at the unrest after the death of Freddie Gray and said, why are people tearing up their own community? Why are people responding in this way? And many of us were saying, this reflects the frustration of years of this community. This reflects the frustration of not being heard. This reflects the frustration of not being believed. This reflects the frustration of not believing that police officers in their community, at least all of them, are fully engaged in public safety.
I mean, this is the city of Freddie Gray.
This is the city of Freddie Gray. So for those, you know, I tweeted out this week, you know, where is the national media on this? Because, you know, the national media descended on Baltimore when the unrest was happening to find out, you know, what was going on and why were people so-called rioting. And, you know, the language that was used to describe these young people, that they were thugs and so forth. But now when we get this really important piece of the puzzle— to explain what really was happening in these communities, the national media is not in Baltimore. They're not there to get the answer. And so I think this case is so important because to the extent that we're looking at this in around the country, issues of policing and the need for policing reform, Baltimore provides a perfect place to look at it. Look, this is not just about the community. This is also about officers. We talked about good apples and bad apples. If you're a good apple, I mean, when what we're hearing this week, the revelations in this trial, suggest that no good apple could prevail in that environment. In fact, there's one officer who was a new trainee, went out with one of these seasoned officers, and when it was clear that he would not rob drug dealers, he was no longer asked to be part of the task force. So police officers themselves, to those who have integrity and those who believe in public safety, should be interested in this case, should care about this, and should want change to happen.
You also tweeted, as you castigated the national media, saying, "Where are you?" Mm-hmm. You said that this corruption trial has the potential to reframe our entire national conversation about law enforcement and minority communities.
Absolutely, because, as I suggested, it confirms so many things that the community had been saying over years. And the reframing that needs to happen is to bring those voices to the table, to allow those voices to have air, to let them be believed that communities are a key part of the public safety narrative. Without question, Baltimore has been besieged by violent crime over the past few years. And I've been saying for some time that until we resolve the issue of policing and trust between the legitimate distrust that many members of the community have for law enforcement, we can't deal with issues of public safety. And this demonstrates the way in which communities have been preyed upon by officers in ways that make them unwilling to trust the police. They will not call and say, "This is what I saw." They will not be witnesses. They will not trust those who claim they need their help to solve crimes. So until we deal with that issue, until we deal with the legitimate distrust of the community towards law enforcement because of officers like those in this task force, we can't get to the kind of public safety outcomes that everyone wants.
Your organization has just sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Justice about Baltimore and about the lack of training that's been exposed by an academy instructor. Explain what's going on.
Okay, here's the other shoe that drops. If you can believe this, Amy, last Friday, the officer charged with training the police recruits in legal standards that govern their conduct announced on Friday that a third of the recruits set to graduate last weekend, had failed the tests, the basic scenario training tests that govern their knowledge of the legal standards under which they are to operate. That is, probable cause for arrests and so forth. A third of the recruits. Now, this is not Sherrilyn Ifill who said this. This is the officer charged with training the recruits who rings the alarm bell and warns that a third of them are not ready. They graduate anyway on Saturday. And so we sent a letter to the Department of Justice. We sent a letter to the mayor saying no officer who has failed the test of constitutional policing should be patrolling our streets. This is not fair to the community. It's also not fair to those cadets. Retrain them, train them until they can pass the test. Instead, what they did was they gave them an older, less rigorous test so that they could all pass. This is the kind of thing that this is happening while this trial is happening, while we're moving forward with the consent decree. And part of what we asked for is we want to integrate all of these processes. We want to bring this all to the table. This is a difficult job for the mayor, a difficult job for the new police chief, without question, a difficult job through this consent decree. But it begins with confronting the problem. And the problem is not just that there's violence in the community, which is how it's too often framed by city leaders. The problem is that there are also problems in the police department. Even the Fraternal Order of Police came out the same day and said, you know, officers need better training to meet these constitutional standards.
They actually thanked the academy instructor.
That's right.
His name, Sergeant
Rosenblatt.
Josh Rosenblatt.
Yes.
And he's quoted in the Baltimore Sun as saying, "We're giving them a badge and a gun tomorrow, the right to take someone's life."
That's right.
If it calls for it, and they have not demonstrated they can meet basic constitutional and legal standards.
Can it be more condemning? What a line that comes out of the police department, not from the outside. And so to me, that's a cry for help. For him to publicly say that, he is ringing the alarm bell that even the police union can hear, that anyone can hear. And yet those officers graduated anyway. And so our letter really demands that the mayor and that the police chief deal with these officers, make sure that they're trained properly, re-examine the training that they're even providing, and be able to say to the community of Baltimore that we have put no officer on the street who has not been fully and adequately trained and who has not demonstrated his or her competence in understanding the laws that govern their conduct. A badge, a shield, a gun, a taser, pepper spray. These are the instruments, the implements that we give these individuals to walk through the community.
I mean, there are so many cases here and so many you've been involved with. This is from WBAL, former Baltimore Police Detective Mamadou Gando also said Deputy Commissioner Dean Palmier coached officers on what to say after a fatal shooting in 2009. Former Gun Squad Detective Jamel Ryan shot and killed Sean Kennedy after a traffic stop. Gando said Ryan said it was a close-range shot, and Ryan was heard to say, "I just didn't want to chase him."
Yet another case, and that deputy commissioner resigned this week. He says it's unrelated to this. He says he did not coach this officer. But yes, Sean Kennedy was killed. Turns out it was at close range. Shockingly, his family received only a $100,000 verdict in their wrongful death suit. Yet another revelation that came out of this trial. I mean, this is, I don't know how to even describe the depth of corruption that we have heard and lawlessness that we have heard in this trial. And this should be echoing throughout the nation, not to dump on Baltimore, to recognize that the community has legitimate concerns, that this is a law enforcement apparatus that needs real help, and really to reinforce for us something that you raised, Amy, the importance of a federal presence. This would not have come to light without that investigation by Rod Rosenstein, by the U.S. attorney.
By the man who's under serious fire by President Trump right now.
Right now, this would not have, we would not have an apparatus for transformation without this federal consent decree that came as a result of the pattern and practice investigation by Loretta Lynch when she was attorney general. This all has come as a result of federal intervention. And yet we have a president and attorney general now who have put the brakes on it. They have turned off the tap on pattern and practice investigations, and they will no longer use their resources to engage in those kinds of investigations in communities, and no longer even work with police departments cooperatively as they had been doing in some jurisdictions. You might have seen that San Francisco, in the city of San Francisco, the state attorney general is now taking over the policing reform apparatus because the Department of Justice has kind of withdrawn. So this is that this narrative about what it really takes to transform police departments and the critical importance of federal intervention is part of the story of Baltimore as well.
And also you have this year the enormous rise of activism, people at the grassroots trying to hold those accountable. And just this past weekend, you have in Baltimore organizers of a grassroots violence effort in Baltimore declaring a successful ceasefire this past weekend. So while some Baltimore police are on trial for acting like criminals, street organizers are keeping the peace. Explain what this ceasefire is.
Well, Amy, this is an incredible movement that has sprung up from the grassroots in Baltimore, community leaders just saying no more. It turns out third time's the charm. This is the third time that Baltimore ceasefire has attempted to have a ceasefire weekend. The first two times, unfortunately, there were killings that happened during those weekends. But nevertheless, it was important for community leaders to speak out, to come out, to say we won't have it. And this time, 72 hours, no murders. This was really important. And, it shows that the community and their own vision of what their community can be is an important part of the public safety equation. It's not just about police officers. It's about community activism. It's about communities taking control of their neighborhoods as well.
All right. So that's ended. So let's go to this one.
Freddie Gray's death in police custody 3 years ago sparked days of protest in Baltimore. And then a struggled to rebuild trust between officers and the community.
How many people have to die?
Now, shocking details have emerged about a deeply corrupt police unit which terrorized the city during this supposed time of reform. The Gun Trace Task Force was an elite unit. Their specific task was to get guns off the street. Today, most of its members have been convicted and are facing decades in prison. This is the story of how the cops became robbers. They preferred a variety of tactics that were very problematic, constitutionally speaking. One of them was called the door pop.
These officers would drive their car, gun it toward a group of black males on the corner. Most of the people they stopped were black males. Then they would stop it and see who would run. So if you have an unmarked car coming at you, there are 300 plus murders, you're going to feel that, oh my goodness, it's probably someone's coming to shoot up the sidewalk.
So another tactic that the officers used was something called a sneak and peek. Sneak and peek means getting to a place like a home, a vehicle, and going inside without a warrant. It's an opportunity for the officers to look around, find out if they have what they need for a warrant, and write it up.
Uniformed cops come in. Well, one of them was talking, the other one was already in the house searching.
Take, for example, the story of Javon. She says that after her husband was arrested in 2010, the officers showed up at her front door without a warrant.
They come back in, and they was like, well, we're going to go get a search warrant. So I was like, okay, you already searched the home, though.
Dope Boy cars are specific makes and models of cars that Sergeant Wayne Jenkins thought were frequently used by drug traffickers.
He pulled in front of me, and the lights came on.
When Andre Crowder was pulled over and arrested, he was driving one of the sergeant's favorite types of Dope Boy cars, an Acura TL.
Oh, we stopped you because you didn't have a seatbelt on. At the time, I wasn't thinking, how did he see I didn't have a seatbelt on? I got tinted windows, you have tinted windows.
Finally, on the stand, officers admitted that their sergeant specifically instructed them to carry BB guns in order to plant them on unarmed people. Seizing illegal guns is difficult investigative police work. That is not what these officers were doing.
Robbery, drug dealing, and a web of lies to cover it all up. The downfall of the elite gun trace task force was one of the biggest scandals in Baltimore police history. Now a judge has handed down lengthy prison sentences. WGZ investigator Mike Kelgren is live at the federal courthouse with the price of corruption. Mike?
It's a heavy one, Vic. The sergeant who used to run the gun trace task force got 25 years. He cried in court and told the judge he's now found God. His former subordinate got 18 years. He told the judge he didn't do anything wrong. Two former Baltimore City police officers will serve extensive time behind bars.
We find out that corrupt cops who swore to protect and serve are nothing more than criminals.
A judge sentenced Sergeant Wayne Jenkins to 25 years in federal prison.
You have a gun and cocaine, probably, I would say, 2.25 just by looking at it.
The former head of the corrupt Baltimore Police Gun Trace Task Force wept and apologized for crimes that prosecutors say included at least 10 armed robberies, planting evidence, falsifying overtime, and selling $1 million worth of drugs, including prescriptions looted from pharmacies after Freddie Gray's death.
Do you have anything you'd like to say on behalf of your brother?
No, sir.
Jenkins' family declined comment, but he wept in court, apologizing to his loved ones and the people of Baltimore, including victims like the Davis sisters, whose dad died after Jenkins wrongfully started a car chase.
He apologized for it, Mr. Jenkins, but it still hurts.
Do you trust the police department after what your family has been through?
No, sir. No, never.
Can anything change that?
I don't think so. Not now.
Unlike Jenkins, former Detective Marcus Taylor went to trial. He also was sentenced today. He got 18 years. Taylor told the judge he was innocent and vowed to fight his conviction.
We're disappointed in the sentence, and he'll be appealing.
And he does maintain his innocence?
He does, and he did to the court today.
Something really wrong if this doesn't send the right message.
And the judge said she wanted to send a message of deterrence. She says that this has undermined the justice system in Baltimore. More than 1,700 criminal cases in the city have been impacted by the actions of these officers. Live at the federal courthouse, Mike Helgren, WJZ.
Mike, thank you. Tomorrow, two more task force officers will be sentenced in the corruption scandal.
This is Mike Wood. He joined the Baltimore Police Department in 2003 when he was 24, but retired last year with a shoulder injury, disillusioned and feeling as if he was hurting the people of Baltimore more than helping them. He's a friendly, outgoing, and charismatic guy. I shouldn't have been surprised, since over the past month, he's gotten a lot of practice at being camera ready. After going on a Twitter rant in which he revealed a series of awful things that he saw his fellow officers do while on the job, he has become the go-to dissident in the law enforcement community for journalists everywhere, an informed critic with an inside view of a culture that has come under unprecedented scrutiny over the past year. For all the talking Mike has done since going public with his stories, I didn't feel like I had a clear understanding of what being a police officer in Baltimore was actually like for him, what the job had demanded, and how the culture of the Thin Blue Line had affected his thinking about the role of cops in the lives of Baltimore's least fortunate, most vulnerable residents. With a notebook full of questions, I headed down there and asked Mike to give me a tour of his old stomping grounds.
You just ran a red light.
Yeah, it happens. There's nobody here.
We drove through his different posts, starting with the Baltimore Police Academy, the place where new recruits go to train before they're sent out into the street.
You guys can see what it is. It's a refurbished, abandoned school. It's disgusting on the inside. Like, that's one thing that gets lost a lot, is how the officers are actually treated in Baltimore, and they are not treated good. Like, the Eastern District where I was would have literally sinks hanging off the wall.
He told me story after story that would leave anyone dumbfounded and angry.
The officer comes around the corner and just boots him in the face as hard as he can.
He just turns and just smacks her, like, open.
Got out and, you know, threw the guy off the bike, picked up the guy's shoes, threw the guy's shoes onto the roof.
I had heard about some of this stuff already from Mike's Twitter feed. What I really wanted to understand was why it happened. How does this culture of contempt and violence towards black people take hold in a police department like Baltimore's? And how is it perpetuated, even after an entire year of police scandals being in the headlines?
For a while, when you're in field training, you're still technically a trainee. You could have been fired at any moment. For the first year, you can get fired for anything. You're just in pencil. It was during that time period where, like, even if I would have spoken out, somebody could have just been like, well, you're fired. See you later. You can't, like, when you're in that probationary stage, you can't upset the apple cart at all. You're going to be gone if you do.
Can you just describe sort of what you learned about police culture during those early days?
Yeah, you don't learn about it. You hear the past stories, and you see when a cop does something wrong. You see the unions, and you see the politicians stand up for the officer. You don't see anyone stand up for the citizen. They just become a statistic, a number that you're going after.
That us versus them attitude, I mean, I understand how it is reinforced by, you know, the rhetoric that comes out of police unions, for example. How does it manifest itself in interactions that police have with people, like, on a daily basis?
Right, so that's even a misnomer in itself, that you walk the beat and talk to citizens.
Okay.
So no one does that. I would try to be friendly with people, but really the reality is if I spent an hour talking to a citizen, that was an hour that everyone viewed I should have been out getting statistics.
And what were those statistics that you should have been hitting?
So normally it's drugs, and that's your main focus, is drugs or Part 1 crimes, which would generally be felonies that have significant jail time. And guns, which is a misdemeanor, but that's a big thing here. So that's everything. Like there is no walking and talking to the community. That's what you do in policing. You're trying to do what keeps you out of trouble from all the problems that are internal. Like, I never feared the streets, but I constantly feared other officers.
How has the climate sort of in the city shifted since Freddie Gray was killed and the riots happened? I mean, these people that we just passed, like, do they live in fear of police? They live across the street from where Freddie Gray was killed.
Right, so what they fear is that we can get away with whatever we choose to get away with. The laws are to the point where anybody can be locked up pretty much for any time. Like, one of the cases I did in the Senate in Maryland, I testified to, was how you can't actually drive a car legally. I mean, it would be impossible. No one can get this car from here to the end of the street completely legally.
So an officer can arrest you at any moment?
At any point in time. So you're constantly ready to be a problem.
Do you want to go back to the story you were telling before? So you were called on the radio for backup.
I hear the call, and I'm not too far away from where we are right now. I'm in a position to head off the guy that's running. I get out of my car, get into a nice place, and corner the guy in an alley. You know, he turns and sees me. We have a little bit of struggle. I put him on, we get on the ground. He gets the handcuffs on. And all in all, this is just like a passively resisting arrest. No cop should ever be upset when a suspect passively resists being taken to jail. That's what you should expect. And I got him down with the handcuffs, and the officer turned the corner to the alley and just kicked him in the face as hard as he could, it seemed to be, because his face swelled up instantly. He had a nice black eye, it was a contusion.
Why does he do that? What is the kick for?
All right, so I'm guessing, but my guess is that he's pissed off that he lost the foot chase.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, would I be pissed off if I lost the foot chase? Yeah, I've lost foot chases. It pisses you off.
So, I mean, everyone gets angry in their jobs, right?
Yeah, can you imagine if the cashier got mad that, you know, she rung up the thing wrong and decided to punch the customer in the face?
The key thing to understand, Mike told me, is that in many cases, the officers who treat people like that are doing so because they're afraid.
I have always thought that those are the ones that actually cross the line more, is the ones that are afraid. And that's our standard in policing, is fear. So if you're afraid, you can do whatever you want. That's the legal standard.
Oh.
So if I am afraid that you can take my life, then I'm allowed to take yours, right, legally.
Where does the fear come from, then? Like, in the guys that do have the fear, it sounds like you think that a lot of them, or most of them, do.
The pussies. I'm not afraid to say it. They were the people that were afraid before they came in, and just because you got a badge and a gun doesn't suddenly mean you're not afraid.
I don't think most people think of police officers as being afraid, as being primarily afraid.
Deathly afraid. There's cops that won't get out of their car when there's a fight with a guy and another officer.
To some extent, they're taught to be afraid, right? That we were, you know, those
they've
shown videos in which guys who hesitate, you know, a second too long are blown away by some madman in the street.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. I mean, that is actually what they show you. They show you the videos. There's an infamous one of a cop who is getting shot at and actually just seems afraid to pull the trigger at another human being. Like the guy was so empathetic that he couldn't, even though he was going to lose his life, he like couldn't bring himself to kill another human being. And that's a video they show all the time.
Fear, Mike said, has a nasty tendency to turn into a kind of constant low-level anger.
What feels sort of within the bounds of acceptable behavior in Baltimore, at least during the time when you were on the job, to do with your anger?
Yeah, I mean, they don't have much of a release. So I think a lot of it gets built up in like bitterness of the people and of the environment, not in a productive way. Like, they generally don't go and work out. They don't deflate themselves. Instead, they'll get angry at the citizens, give further into that us versus them, and, you know, start their infamous drinking problems that you hear about with police. You know, that's real, because it is a stressful thing.
So officers are ambiently angry and afraid for their lives at every turn. And the people they're supposed to be serving are afraid and defensive about the possibility of being hassled by a surly cop and carted off to jail for no reason. What Mike is describing is a vicious cycle, and while he's not the first guy in the world to characterize it as such, I wondered if he had any thoughts on how it might be broken.
If we actually did a community policing model designed to have decentralized power so that the patrol officer can take care of things in his or her responsibility area. So, in a true community policing model, if I came down here and I see this overgrown brush, I have the power and the resources to get city workers or something like that down here to fix that. I should have the ability to get weed whackers and recruit people in the neighborhood. And maybe for that day of work, instead of locking people up, I came out with the neighborhood and did this, because that would have some kind of improvement overall.
Driving through the utterly dilapidated Sandtown neighborhood, looking at the memorial that has been erected in honor of Freddie Gray, it strikes me that clearing out an overgrown bush feels like pretty small potatoes. Plus, while community policing seems like an obviously good idea in principle, it's my sense that it usually ends up being little more than a buzzword in practice, that police culture inevitably overwhelms it.
Well, that's the thing, though. I mean, I think culture, like, is the transmission of values, like, from one person to another. I don't know if it goes laterally or if it goes from, like, the, you know, from the top down in terms of rank. You know, you do as your commander or your captain says, and you think the way he thinks. But it has to, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm asking. Like, is there a path along which change can kind of travel?
What we have to do is we have to start thinking about what are we actually doing and what are our goals. So if our goals are to reduce violent crime, we have to change our metrics. So right now our metric is arrest. That's what judges an officer. So who's in charge of these metrics? It's command and it's politicians. So we have to change the metric to crime reduction, to justice, to problem solving. So that would be a continual metric where you would always have something to do, where you would always improve the community, because you should be focused on improving your post, not on locking up many of those people up on your post. Because if you're taking their freedom away, how are you not going to be their enemy?
Close out our tour, Mike took me to a part of Baltimore that was very different from everything we'd seen so far. A white neighborhood on the north side of town. It's where he was transferred after about 4 years in the force. He found the contrast astonishing. He also found it difficult to make his numbers because all of a sudden he didn't have anyone to arrest. His solution? Drive 2 blocks away into a part of town where he could easily find young black men.
So who would you arrest here? For what? It seems like you need a reason. You were saying earlier that
but
it's arbitrary.
But you don't! That's the thing you're not understanding. So like they were in the street.
Uh-huh.
That's enough?
Yeah.
Jaywalking. Okay, so if they throw a cigarette on the ground, you can do it. And people do those petty arrests. You'll see them. So Freddie Gray being arrested for a spring-loaded pocket knife, you can't tell me that black people carry spring-assisted pocket knives at a greater ratio than white people do. Or even Hispanics, because they're doing the construction sites around here. That's a ridiculous thing to say. Of course we all have spring... I have a spring-assisted pocket knife. Conveniently, legally, there's a exception for police. Imagine that. So when you go and you look at the arrest records, what are you going to see? But the people here are carrying spring-assisted pocket knives at the same ratio as the people up there. So we're not focused on the crime of the spring-assisted pocket knife. We're focused on the crime of being black and poor.
Listening to Mike talk, I found it depressingly easy to understand why distrust and hostility flow so freely between the police and the city and the communities they're supposed to be protecting. That us versus them mentality that Mike was talking about earlier, it gets reinforced and sharpened systematically, almost by design, and it poisons every interaction that cops in Baltimore have with the city's residents. Until the police figure out what the people who live here actually need from them, what it would take for officers to start improving people's lives instead of making them harder, sadder, less free, the anger and the fear that Mike Wood saw on the job are just going to persist.
We're setting the stage and then going, oh my gosh, look at this stage. Well, yeah, we created it.
Okay, so that was the last clip. I'm going to close the show up because we're having a thunderstorm. And I don't want the lights to go out while we're having a conversation, unfortunately. And it seems to be coming down pretty good. So I just played those clips for you. And hopefully, you know, get something out of it tonight. Next week, I'll do another topic on I'll do the same topic on a different police force. We'll talk about some more corruption and why, you know, people in the urban communities don't trust police and these police departments. So, unfortunately, you know, it's out of my hands how this weather is, and I don't want to take the chance of the lights going out and the show ending, you know, weirdly. So So I'm going to close it out tonight, but I'll be back next week with another topic, and hopefully we won't, you know, hopefully the weather will cooperate. You know, we can have rain, but, you know, as far as the thunder and lightning goes, we kind of don't need that. So I'll be back next week with another topic. And what can I say? Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.